why are we here? Or can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things and breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Welcome to Life and Faith for 2019. We've had a long break, but we're back and we're looking forward to bringing you conversations about things that matter.
Well, you had a long break, a particularly long break, Simon.
Yeah, I really did. I actually was on long service leave the end of last year and then early this year.
So nice for some.
It was, I must admit. It was great. We were pretty tired at the end. Well, I was pretty tired at the end of last year.
It was
year.
A big year.
CPX people were tired after getting out the documentary. Have we mentioned we made a documentary on the impact
of Christianity?
It's called
For the Love of God, The Church is Better and Worse Than You Ever Imagined.
And it was a big project. We were all pretty tired at the end of that, and I was especially feeling tired. But anyway, so it was a good timing for me.
Any highlights?
Yeah, there's lots. Lots of highlights for long service leave. One of the things that was interesting, we did travel. So I went with my family back to Canada. We used to live in Canada, in Vancouver. And we went back. My daughter was born there. So it was sort of fun to take the family back and see where we used to live. And one of the things that struck me there was that for my American friends, Canadian friends, long service leave is an utterly foreign concept. They couldn't believe it when I told them. And it reminded me what a gift that is. And my policy has always been, and this is a recommendation for me, never die with long service leave owing.
Good life philosophy. Good motto. As long as you're not American, I guess.
It served me well. But anyway, we are back and Life and Faith makes a return.
And we've got lots of great stuff in the can that we've got already recorded from last year. Oz Guinness, Alison and John Milbank we spoke to recently.
Yeah, we did. And another episode coming up will involve me talking to my butcher.
I'm looking forward to hearing that.
The ethics of eating, which I think is a really fun topic. But today we're kicking off the year with something a bit different. It's a conversation with a Nigerian YouTuber who is someone who's found a kind of fun way to talk about serious subjects.
Yay! Welcome to my new studio. What's up, people? It's your girl, Adeola. Thank you so much. Yes, we made
it. So, Natasha, tell us how you came across Adeola Fayoum, because that's a good story in itself.
Yeah, so this was a bit of an impromptu interview. I was at a charity dinner, one of those posh do's at Sydney Uni late last year, and she was the speaker. She was giving a lecture. So this was a charity dinner run by The Chaser, which are the satirical comedy group. If you haven't heard of them, they have some quite funny pranks you can go watch on YouTube. So it's not just a dinner. They have a lecture. It was called the Perennial Inaugural Chaser Lecture. So it's kind of serious, kind of not a serious thing. And Adeola was the guest speaker for this year. So she's a Nigerian journalist, and she gets up to speak and she talks about how when they wrote to her to ask her to come and give this lecture, and it's called the Perennial Inaugural, which makes no sense in actual fact, and they offered to pay her expenses to bring her to Australia and everything, she was a bit like,
is this a real thing?
Is this a scam? Do you think that you can scam a Nigerian? I don't think so.
Right.
And she talked about how she had grown up in Nigeria. She now lives in the US. And growing up, she'd had regular power outages. The water would go out. She just thought this was kind of normal growing up. And then when she moved to the US, she realized that actually it really doesn't have to be this way. And that kind of has driven her journalism, her activism. But of course, in the middle of telling us all this, the power goes out in the middle of her lecture.
No.
Twice.
And this was a scam, wasn't it? That they were being...
Well, I don't know. So
they've been pranked.
Well, it's hard to tell with The Chaser, right? So earlier in the evening, we'd actually had a fire alarm go off and we had to evacuate in the middle of our dinner and in our posh dresses and so on. And I think that part was a prank on The Chaser.
The power, I'm not sure. Just a disaster.
It might have just been a little bit unfortunate, yes.
Mm. and she felt at home because of it.
Well, unfortunately so, perhaps. But yeah, she was amazing. And listening to her, I was like, well, you know, I'd really like to do an interview with her. And she sounds like someone who rolls with the punches. She's actually famous for a few years back, she accosted Robert Mugabe, who was coming out of an event in Nigeria. And
this is Robert Mugabe, the infamous Zimbabwean leader.
Yeah, who'd been in power for like 37 years. And she accosted him and was like, when are you going to step down? Which is not a question that journalists or anybody usually asks Robert Mugabe. So that was kind of a like sensation around the world. And I was like, okay, I feel like she's someone who's up for impromptu interviews.
We've got to talk to this woman.
Absolutely.
My name is Adeola Fayeon. I'm from Nigeria originally, and I'm a journalist, and I produce a weekly show about African politics and other issues about Africa. It's a satirical show, and it's on YouTube.
And it's huge.
Is it?
It has a lot of fans.
Well, it has, you know, some fans. So,
how did you end up doing that?
I just wanted to do something about the situation back home, because when I moved to the U.S. to go to college, I was really disappointed to see that you could have basic amenities, really. And that's all that I asked for on my show, just stable electricity, stable running water, and good roads. And I found out when I got to the U.S. that all these things are actually possible. And I found out the U.S. is actually not heaven. It's just another place where the leaders are more responsible and they take care of basic amenities for the people. And so doing the show is my way of advocating for basic amenities for my people.
So how do you do that?
So once in a while, I would show pictures and videos of what life is like elsewhere. I have shown several videos of and pictures of hospitals in the U.S., in Dubai, and other places. And I would talk about how much they spent to build that kind of hospital. For example, I've showed hospitals built with $10 million. And then I would talk about how $20 billion disappeared. And for example, when the $20 billion disappeared in the Nigerian oil sector, I talked about what the money could do. There was someone accused of stealing $2 billion, and I showed what they did with $2 billion in Dubai and what we can do with such amount of money. So I want my audience to see, not just in developed countries, but I also show development in other African countries. Like Kenya, for example, they constructed their trains and their train station for like $3 billion. And it's so much nicer, so much better than the one that we constructed with $12 billion. And, you know, I would compare them, show them side by side, just for Nigerians to know you're being scammed. This is what your money could do. You're supposed to have three times what they have in Kenya.
So is the problem that people at home aren't aware of that, it's not reported, or that people are apathetic, that they need to kind of what the problem is?
I think we've gotten so used to mediocrity for so long that we've gotten used to it, that we don't see anything wrong in how some of our officials treat us, the citizens. And while one aspect of what I do is to challenge our officials to do better and to shame them, I think a major aspect of what I do is to wake up the people, to wake up the masses and tell them, hey, look, you're being scammed. Because I think it's very important for the mentality of the people to change so that they can expect more and demand for their rights. It was weird to me to have electricity uninterrupted for weeks when I moved to the U.S. because I was so used to it that I didn't think anything was wrong when they take off the light when I was growing up. Right now in Nigeria, we have a new generation of people growing up that think Boko Haram is okay. Boko Haram is the terrorist organization killing people. We have a new generation of people that think it's okay for bomb explosions to go off and stuff like that. And so I'm trying to wake people up, and not just in Nigeria. I talk about African countries as well, so that they can know we have a lot in common and our differences, and so that we can all together demand for better governance and to make our leaders accountable.
To feel that things can be different.
Yes, because it should be. You know, when you look at politics, it's like a few people governing millions of people. The people need to know that the power lies with them. They own the power. And when the people realize the power that they have, they will no longer be oppressed by those who are leading them that are supposed to develop the country. So I think a main reason why I do this is to empower people, to equip them, to open their eyes, to wake them up, to get them to demand for their rights, because I want them to know they deserve better.
And in comedy and satire, is that, do you think that's an important element of how you can
think
make that
it
happen?
Is. I think it is, because first of all, I don't want my viewers to watch the show and just get depressed all the time, because news can be depressing. You know, we journalists, we don't always cover good news. It's usually when something yeah. is bad, when something bad happens, we're like, that's news, you know. So I don't want viewers to be depressed all through, although some of the stories that I do cover can be very depressing. So, but I try to make them laugh. First of all, I want to enjoy what I do, and I do enjoy what I do. I have a lot of fun when I'm shooting, but I also want my viewers to enjoy listening to the news. I want them to laugh, to be entertained, at the same time to learn a few things. And I would get emails from people that would tell me that in the same episode, I cried, I laughed, and I was inspired in one episode because of the different stories that I talked about. So that has really helped me in reaching people. Have people that would write me and say they no longer read news from home because it's so depressing, but then they watch my show and they get the news from there, and they also get entertainment from it. So that's why I use
satire.
So you're
kind of sneaking past people's defenses and getting them to watch news that they mightn't.
Yeah, I thought I would give people a reason to watch me. Yeah. All the news that I talk about, first of all, most of these stories, they are not breaking news. They've seen it on BBC, ABC, CNN, everywhere. They just wanted to hear my spin on it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They wanted to see how I would present it. So I thought I would give people a reason to watch me. That's why I don't just sit down and read the news like the traditional newscast. So I wanted to give people a reason to come back. So actually, that's why I tried to make it funny. I don't think I'm that funny.
In 2015, there was a big international splash when you ambushed Robert Mugabe, the president of Zimbabwe, and kind of accosted him and threw some questions at him.
President, don't you think that it's time to step down, sir? Is there like a time limit?
Tell me what happened there.
So I didn't ambush him.
The news stories definitely say ambush.
He was walking out of the venue of the inauguration, the stadium. And you know, the funny thing about that story is when he came in the morning, I saw him and I went to his car. I wanted to interview him. He was in the car, but the camera guy was not with me. So it was just me, and he was there, and there was no reporter, nobody else there. And I was like, oh, this was a great opportunity. I could interview him, but the camera guy wasn't there. So I went to look for the camera guy. By the time I came back, the whole car was swamped with reporters. Everybody wanted to interview him. So I was like, well, there goes the opportunity to interview Mugabe. I was like, life goes on. So we did the inauguration. And at the end of the day, at the end of the inauguration, when he was leaving, I was walking out, and all the other presidents, they had their convoy come into the stadium to pick them up. But for some weird reasons, he was walking out to his car. I was like, wait, this is another opportunity to talk to him. So I was trying to get close, and I heard all these reporters saying, Mr. President, give us a smile, because they were taking his picture. And I was like, what the heck? Why are we asking Mugabe to smile? This is Mugabe. You know, this is a man that has refused to step down all this. And I've talked about him a lot on my show. Okay. And I was like, we should ask when he will step down. That's why I was asking, like, Mr. President, when are you going to step down? You know, when can we come to Zimbabwe for something like this? And, you know, the whole thing, I thought it was just like another aspect of my show, you know, like trying to make things funny, like, oh, this is Mugabe, we're asking when he will step down. I had no idea that the world is that interested in Mugabe. And of course, I had no idea that people don't normally ask him when he will step down, which I thought was the reasonable question to ask. Because after that interview, I left and I was visiting a sister of mine in Nigeria. and my phone just started buzzing. Now, I didn't have access to internet at this time. I had left the city of Abuja. And I was like, why are all these people calling me? And then I saw 3 missed calls from BBC. I was like, what did I do? Like, what is going on? Why is BBC calling me? How did BBC get my phone number? So then when I finally spoke with them, they were like, oh, your interview with Mugabe. I was like, what interview? Because I didn't even know they had uploaded the video. And when we did the interview, I thought maybe 5,000 people would watch. I was wrong. The next thing I knew, the video had circulated. By the following day, the Minister of Information in Zimbabwe had written an article about me, which was so weird because I went to see a boss of mine in Nigeria at one of the newspapers that I freelance for in the US as a foreign correspondent. And as soon as I got in to see my boss, he was reading a big newspaper and he was like, well, I was just reading about you. I was like, oh God, what have I done? And it was so funny how everything happened so quickly. And of course, it came with a lot of backlash, people abusing me that I had no respect. How dare you ask a 90-something-year-old man when he would step down, this is that. But you know, I don't regret asking when he would step down. I think it's unfortunate that he had to stay there until they kicked him out, basically, the military, because he had no reason to have been there for 37 years. And considering that he started out well as a freedom fighter, to see how it ended, it's like a huge lesson for so many of the African leaders that why don't you just follow the example of Nelson Mandela, you know?
And you spend a lot of your time asking uncomfortable questions of powerful men, usually. You're not easily intimidated, I gather. Why is that?
Well, first of all, I think the fact that I was trained in the US, I think my mentality is different. And I'm not saying that my mentality is better than anybody's mentality, but I don't see you as a god. I see you as a human being. And I'm talking about politicians. Because in the US, the politicians are very responsive. They are accountable. They give feedback. And, you know, they take questions from journalists. I was used to that. I never practiced journalism in Nigeria until I was in graduate school. And then I went to Nigeria for internship. And I was like, this something is wrong here. In the sense that I noticed that a lot of journalists are afraid of politicians and they don't ask the obvious questions. Some of them will ask questions that would make the politician look good. And I have a problem with that. Second of all, because I had lived in the US, I think I had this anger with me that I had from the day that I arrived and I saw how life is here and I was like, damn, I've been cheated. So I think that drives why I ask questions. It's not like I'm fearless or anything. It's just, that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to ask the hard questions. At least that's what we were trained to do in school.
This is Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. Today we're bringing you an interview Natasha did with Adeola Fayoun. She's a Nigerian journalist who presents a satirical news show that particularly takes aim at corrupt African leaders.
Yes, and that includes corrupt religious leaders. She had quite a bit to say about them.
You know, coming from Nigeria, I honestly feel like the church has failed the people. It's not just our politicians that have failed us, but the church has failed us big time. I've done several episodes on my show about what religious leaders do. I've done episode about tithe and offering because there was a time that, even till now, there has been a major issue in Nigeria, how pastors would take tithe from politicians that they know are stealing money, and they would take this money from them and they would not ask any questions. We have pastors with several private jets in Nigeria and they boast about these things. And then they would preach and then tell people to come and sow seed, and they have the guts to tell them, if you have $1,000, come out, stay on this side. The Lord is telling me 10 people are supposed to sow $1,000, come out. And it's like, which Lord is telling you this? That is definitely not in my Bible. And to see how they've twisted the Bible for their own financial gain is very, very annoying. First of all, they are misrepresenting Christianity. A lot of people that are not Christians, they see a lot of our religious leaders as just people looking for money. Things like that, it makes me mad because they're misrepresenting Jesus, they're misrepresenting Christianity. It makes me upset that this is what Christianity has been reduced to in Nigeria. It's all about making money, being successful. A lot of the messages that I listen to so many of them, they just preach about prosperity, and it's like, this is not what Christianity is about. And I guess another reason it makes me upset, and I've talked about this on my show, is the missionaries that brought the gospel to Nigeria, they were not like that. They risked their lives. Many of them even died from malaria and stuff like that. We don't even know many of their names. But you know what? They left legacy, and their legacy were schools and hospitals. Those who brought the gospel to Nigeria, they gave us education. They built schools that were free. They built hospitals that were free. They treated people. But the churches today are not doing that. They're just taking and taking from people. And that hurts my heart because I feel like that's not what Jesus would like to see happening today.
Right. So you're a believer yourself. It's not that you are criticizing Christianity. So you think it should look different from that. What do you want the churches to look like in Nigeria?
I just want Christians to be like Jesus, really. He never lived in an expensive house, or they try to justify what they do to say, oh, Jesus was, he had the best of everything, whatever. I don't think that was the situation. I think whatever he had at the time, he shared with everybody that was with him. He had no home, according to the Bible. And to answer your question, yes, I am a Christian. And honestly, I wouldn't do what I'm doing today if not for the grace of God. I'm so grateful to God for his love, for his grace. If not for that, I wouldn't have been able to stand in the face of the attack and the backlash and the threats. And so when people say, are you not afraid, it's not really me, because it's like, if I don't do what I'm doing, it's like I don't have peace. I have to say something about it. I'll think about the consequences later. But I guess it's safe for me at this point in my life to say that what I'm doing is my calling. It's what God wants me to do. So if I don't do it, I don't have peace. So, but the main message is I want Christians to be like Jesus. I want them to love like Jesus, you know, to the point that I think we discriminate a lot, especially where I'm from. We judge people based on their physical appearance. Oh, this person is not rich. We don't hang with people that are not rich, or they are not well put together. In so many of our churches, we have the high seats for the pastors. You may be surprised by that, but back home we do. Pastors are the holy people. And also there's something we call like over-spirituality. Like, oh, I'm very spiritual. I don't move with just anybody. I don't make friends with sinners, you know. And, you know, sometimes on my show I will say things like, if Jesus were to be alive today, do you know he would go to a club? And some of them will look at me like, and I'm like, yeah, in the Bible said he was hanging with sinners, okay? That's how he reached so many people. And a lot of the sinners, they loved him. But the Christianity of today is, oh, I'm holy. I try to get people away from that and to get them to just love people from day to day. And sometimes on my show, I'll talk about how just the road that you take to your home, there may be a widow there that has nobody. There may be a child that has no one to send him or her to school. Like, you don't have to go far. You can find a place to be like Jesus wherever you are. And so that's really my message, that the church leaders should stop scamming people and just be like Jesus and love and meet the needs around their neighborhood. Like the two last episodes I did, I talked about this Congolese doctor that was operating on women that had been raped, and he won the Nobel Peace Prize. And I made it clear that he's a pastor as well. he's a pastor, but he wasn't just a pastor on the pulpit. He went beyond being a pastor to meet the needs of people. And to me, that is Christianity. And I think a lot of that came from the fact that I'm actually a missionary kid. A lot of people don't know that. my parents were missionaries. And for me, growing up, what I knew about Christianity is we would go to remote villages around where we live, and we would take clothing and shoes and food to give to the less privileged, and medication, and like pain medication, and whoever needs medical treatment, my dad would take them to the hospital. And, you know, we would sleep on mats and stuff, and go to the river like very early before it's done so that we can take a shower before people can see you. They had no electricity in those villages. So that's how I grew up, and that's what I knew about Christianity, meeting the needs of people. People are more receptive to whatever you have to say when they see that you care. People don't really care what you know until they know that you care about them. So then seeing pastors enriching themselves in the name of Christianity was very, very foreign to what I knew as Christianity growing up. And I think that's what fuels what I do.
How do you imagine God feels about the work that you are doing?
I think I touched on that briefly when I said that I think it's safe for me to think it's part of my calling. So I feel like me doing what I'm doing, because a lot of people don't know this, but it's actually very difficult what I do. And there had been times that I tried to quit and try to do other things, but God just blocked every single door that I knock. He kept blocking them for years, until finally I was like, you know what, I guess this is what he wants me to do. I don't talk about that. People don't know that, because, you know, at the beginning no one knows what you're doing. There's no profit in it, and it's just really hard, and it's a lot of work. So I tried to quit several times, but God was just blocking every other way. But this He made possible, and He's brought me to a point where I look back now and I'm like, thank you, God. You know what you're doing, and like I could see a light at the end of the tunnel. And I'm really grateful for how far He has brought me. But I feel like me doing what I'm doing is part of my calling. I don't mean this is the only thing that I would do with my life, but I do meet people that would tell me, thank you so much for what you do. You're like the voice of the voiceless. I don't like using that word. I don't think I'm the voice of the voiceless. But people say that to me when they meet me. And so to me, it's like I'm doing what God wants me to do, whether they listen and change or not. At least they know that someone is watching. And, you know, hopefully someday history will remember me for good. So at least I can say I tried, because someday if my kids say, well, while all this was happening, Mama, what did you do? I can be like, girl, go on YouTube. I did a little something, you know. So at least I can say I did mine, what I can do.
That's Natasha Moore's conversation with Nigerian satirist Adeola Fayoun. You can watch Adeola on YouTube. Her show is called Keeping It Real with Adeola. And we thought it worth mentioning that here at Centre for Public Christianity, we host an annual public lecture. It's called the Richard Johnson Lecture, and we hold it in Sydney and Melbourne, so apologies to those not in those places. This year, Tim Dixon, formerly a speechwriter and economic advisor to two Australian prime ministers, will deliver the lecture. It's titled Crossing the Great Divide, Building Bridges in an Age of Tribalism. Tim founded an organisation called More in Common, and he has some really interesting things to say about overcoming division in our fractured communities. We thought this was timely. It's on the 12th of March in Sydney and 13th of March in Melbourne. You can still get your tickets at richardjohnson.com.au.
And we will make it available online afterwards to listen to or to watch if you can't make it, or if you're listening to this after the fact. But we would really love you to be there if you can.
Next week, the philosopher John Milbank.
I don't know whether I'm optimistic or pessimistic. I'm not sure that's the point. But I do think there's an opportunity because everything, people are looking for something precisely because things are breaking down. I think that, you know, there's danger of populism and a desire for community to take an ugly, atavistic, nationalist, racist form. But I also think that liberals are far too quick to impose those judgments on ordinary people, and that they can be persuaded towards a good version of what they're looking for.